I'm Dean Newland, and welcome to the Business of Intuition, where I coach, facilitate, train, and speak on the hard science and meaningful experience of intuitive leadership in business, so you can make better decisions, forge real connections, and creatively solve problems to amplify your impact and simplify your life. Welcome to the Business of Intuition.
Like coaching, resilience has made its way into the lexicon and practices of many businesses. Working hard is no longer the only part of the recipe for success. In fact, it could be part of our demise. In Japan, known for its relentless pursuit of success in work and in education, have even come up with a word essentially meaning death by overwork. In our country, companies are slowly beginning to understand that a healthy body and a healthy mind make for a better employee. We know that healthcare costs go down while productivity, engagement scores, creativity, loyalty, and retention go up when we have a resilient workforce. We know that doctors diagnose better, executives make better decisions, team leaders are more aware of the needs of their people if they have what we've been calling for a long time, work-life balance. My next guest on the Business of Intuition is a teacher, thought leader, and practitioner of resilience. His secret sauce? Meditation. David Gandelman is founder of the Meditation School, where he taught people the art of intuition. He is also the host of two podcasts, The Meditation School Energy Matters and Grounded Sleep. He is a guest teacher at Cornell University and NBC Universal, and his Insight Timer meditation app has been streamed for over 30 million minutes.
David, thanks so much for being a guest on the Business of Intuition. I wanted to start off with this distinction between intuition and being psychic. What's the difference? And do we all have that capability?
Sure. Great. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Dean. And I think, you know, those words are kind of interchangeable. I would say there are a number of different intuitive abilities. Being psychic, when a lot of people hear that word, they think of someone who maybe talks to dead people or sees things, right? And sees auras or something in some way. I would say that those are abilities, but a lot of us, like day to day, we might have a lot of intuition that just comes out of like feeling. I'll just walk through them briefly if you like. Yeah. So I would say there's maybe four or five main ones. So the first one, the most common one, is we intuitively feel something. I feel like this person is in pain. I feel like there's danger around this corner. I feel like this is the right thing to do with my business or not, right? We just have a gut feeling. And then the other one that we often get is we might hear our own inner voice, right? We might just hear guidance. Oh, wow, this word came to me. Or this phrase, like, just do it. So I did. So some of us get our intuition through that voice. And then some of us get it through images. So if you're a meditator, close your eyes, you might just see a mental image with your eyes closed. Maybe something that you're working on creating, something that might happen. I don't know. Who knows what the boundaries of that are? But a lot of people will see things through images or experience their intuition through images. And then knowingness. So you don't necessarily feel it or see it or hear it. You just know it. We say, oh, I just knew it off the top of my head. I don't know how I got to that answer. It just landed. I had a guy on one of my podcasts once who was driving, and he just had this knowingness to, like, he was going through a green light, and he just had this knowingness to like hit the brakes real hard, and he hit the brakes and a huge tractor trailer just went right through a red light and would have just crushed him. And he was a movie producer, filmmaker, and he decided to make a movie about intuition and start exploring it. He's like, what was that sense that just saved my life? I have no idea how that happened. Somebody please tell me.
So what was the name of the movie?
Intuition is your GPS, something along those lines. I can't remember the exact title. Something like that. We'll put it in the show notes.
We'll look it up. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a couple of years ago.
So I understand that you have taught people how to be intuitive. You've been at a school.
Yeah.
Give me so some background on that. What is that about? You know, I just find that fascinating that this is something that one could actually learn. And I do believe, as I think you do, that we all are given this gift of intuition. It depends upon whether we trust it, whether we practice it, whether we use it. But how do you teach somebody to be more intuitive?
Sure. Yeah. So I did. I ran a nonprofit school. I was there for 7 years in Hawaii. Pretty cool place to work with intuition. Your listeners must be like, what are you, a trust fund baby? You just live in Hawaii for 7 years and do magic.
Right.
But no, I wasn't. I was hustling to try to make it work. And, you know, when somebody comes through the door the first time, they're like, I want to develop my intuitive skills. The first thing we do is we teach them how to meditate, because if you have a really noisy mind, your emotions are fluctuating too much, it's going to be hard for you to hear, feel, see, or know anything that's more subtle. And most people, they don't realize they have intuition because of all the noise. Because, for example, they're, you know, spending 7 hours a day on their phone, 5 hours on YouTube, you know, and there's just all this input of information, and they don't know how to quiet down to hear the deeper answers that are just sitting there waiting for them. And so the first thing we do is we teach a number of meditation tools, for example, how to ground yourself, how to release energy that you're holding on to, how to have boundaries. Maybe if you feel like a lot of you is lost to the future or to the past, how to bring yourself back into your body, into this moment. So we start off by teaching them a number of tools to help them manage their energy better, quiet their mind, and then we focus their attention. So you can intuitively tap into an animal, into a tree, into a person, into a level of maybe a dimension of creativity, pretty much into your business, into anything. So it really, you know, there are intuitive psychic people out there. They just talk to dead people, right? Like the James Van Proggs and the John Edwards of people who have TV shows. Their whole intuition is based on just talking to somebody who's deceased, which I always found not that, I mean, it's intriguing, but not something I would want to spend my life doing, because I like speaking to people who are alive, like you, who are embodied. You know, that fascinates me more. So I know people who their whole career is talking intuitively to animals. You know, not my thing, but I think that's great if that's what you're into. And if you look back at any tradition, you know, Native Americans, Aboriginals, you know, you go Hawaiians, you go anywhere, you'll see all of this in the cultures. It's just intertwined into most human cultures, except ours, because we're such intellectual creatures.
So rhetorical question, but are we moving away from that as a society?
I think we're moving more into a plurality. So there's this diversification, even like if you look at politics or the news, everyone just kind of is going into their bubbles.
Sure.
So I'm not of the worldview that everything is moving in one direction. I have some very new agey friends who say the shift is happening. Everyone's consciousness is changing. The world is about to shift. And I'm like, that's not what I see. I see groups of people shifting in that way and other groups getting way more extreme and intense and everything else under the sun. So I don't know if I have a grand vision of the way the world is moving, but I just do kind of my part to help people balance their intellectual abilities and their intuitive abilities so they can, you know, work with each other in a healthy way. I think we're definitely leaning way too far into the intellect these days and out of touch with our emotions and our intuition, generally speaking, especially in the corporate world. I've done a lot of corporate coaching and teaching meditation at companies, and it's so unbelievably taboo to talk about your feelings or what you sense. You know, there's this very narrow band of how you're allowed to behave. And I find that alarming. And I also find it exciting to go in and shift that a little bit.
All right. Yeah. So there's a great follow-up question to that. Sure. But I want to get back to something you said about meditation as a way to be able to quiet the mind.
Sure.
I've had definitely meditated over the years, sometimes more than others. And that's always the thing for me personally that I struggle with is how do I turn off this really active head of mine? Yeah. And there may be a mantra, there may be some words that I can focus on, there may be my breathing, but what is your if there's some tips for people who are listening in on this who go, Dean, I know what you're saying. I can't turn off my brain. And that's one reason why I stopped meditating is because it just feels like torture to me. How do you answer that, David?
I think we can come at it from two sides. So the external stuff and the internal stuff. The external stuff, it's like saying, hey, David, I drink alcohol 7 times a day. I don't know why, you know, I'm not finding peace of mind. I'm like, and everyone's doing that. We're just on our phones absorbing insane amounts of information. And I don't think as a society, we realize the damage that it's causing. If you lived with Native Americans, you know, hundreds of years ago, or Aboriginals, or, you know, even if you go to certain places today, like a place like in Tibet or in the Himalayas, some spots I've been to, you'll find people who live still in a very natural kind of way. And you'll find a peace inside yourself just by being with them and being in that place. And then you come back to America or wherever you live in the West and you're like, oh my God, I'm anxious again. What happened?
Yeah.
So there's this external force, right? We're digesting, mentally digesting. If we digested as much food as we do information, if there was a correlation there, we would explode. We would be overweight times a million. And we think just because it's going into the head, we're not digesting it. So we're eating way too much digital information. And so that's causing the mind to spin out, I think, first and foremost. And that's a hard one to fix because we're plugged in like cyborgs, basically, at this point.
Well, it seems like we're also almost addicted, you know, to the technology and to the feeling of being overwhelmed by so much information. You take somebody away from their lifestyle and put them on Maui, for example, or take them up to Boulder, Colorado, where you live, and give them just peace and quiet. I think that after a while, there's some anxiousness that starts to set in because we don't experience that very often. We got to go back to that frenetic lifestyle.
Absolutely. And I've taught a lot of retreats where I'll see people kind of having this withdrawal in the first few days. I would say that's something you need to get through. It's minor. You want to get through that withdrawal. And then on the other side of it, you'll find something pretty amazing. So that's the external side. And then the internal side is, technique. And I don't think there's any one right way to quiet your mind. I know TM, mantra meditation, is very popular. Everyone's kind of different in terms of what works with their personality and their energy. For me, I kind of just made up my style based on a bunch of things that I learned throughout the years traveling and sitting with different teachers and then teaching myself. But what I like to do with my students is first and foremost is try to get them to understand that the inner peace that they're looking for is already there. Hmm. It's not like silence goes away and then you call it in like, hey, silence, come over here. I'm meditating now. Yeah. Or inner peace. It's the natural state of every being. So when we go to meditate, usually what happens to most people is they start judging themselves. My mind is going, I can't sit still. I'm not good at this. There's no inner peace. I quit. And that is actually most of the irritation is their approach towards themselves. So like my back's supposed to be straight. I have to breathe a certain way and everything becomes this like manipulation. How can I manipulate myself into being still and quiet? And how can I turn off my mind? And I think trying to turn off your mind is going to antagonize it more. It's going to create almost a conflict. So what I would say is you don't have to turn off your mind. You'll never be successful at that. I would not worry about that so much. What I like to do with my students where I start them is I'm willing to bet that the thoughts going through your head have some important messages for you. So after a few minutes of meditating and the first few layers of noise just kind of subsiding, then the thoughts that start to come up might actually be really relevant. Yeah. So for example, if you keep ruminating on the same 3 or 4 things every day, and you're like, David, teach me to meditate so I can get those things to go away. Well, they're going to come right back when you get up. So why don't we just face them right now and see what happens? So for example, someone's thinking about an old relationship over and over or something they did at work that invalidated them. And you can't just meditate that away. So I actually like to focus on whatever it is that's coming up and reconcile that. And then on the other side of it, the natural byproduct will be a sense of inner peace and calm. anxiety is always, to me, in my experience and with my students, anxiety is a byproduct of something much deeper. And it's just like the icing on the cake. It's the radiation that's coming off of something that actually needs real attention. So when someone's like, teach me how to meditate, I'm anxious. I'm like, well, how deep do you want to go? Because we could pull off this layer of anxiety. It'll come back every day for the rest of your life if you don't deal with this issue that's really there. So that's how I like to start my students. And then as we go deeper and deeper into down the rabbit hole, then we can get into energy centers and all sorts of other cool stuff. But I would say, at least 80% of people, that's where the majority of the work is for them when they start.
That makes a lot of sense. I think you hit it, that there's a lot of us out there who approach meditation as a way to avoid the troubles of the day. And you're sort of saying, if I can paraphrase, is if you really want to go to some place that's important, follow where your head is taking you. Don't avoid it. It's going to come back sooner or later, so might as well deal with it.
Absolutely. And, I was just teaching a class last night and I said that if you're walking up your own Mount Everest and you're taking one step with your left foot and then one with your right, your left foot is basically self-honesty and your right is acceptance. And if you can keep taking those two steps a thousand times over as you're meditating, you're going to reach the top of your own Everest. So for example, so I sit down to meditate and my mind is noisy. I'm like, oh shit, David told me to, what did he say to do?
Yeah.
First thing, self-honesty. All right. So how do you actually feel? And instead of judging it, trying to manipulate it, avoiding it, mantra it away. Can you be honest with exactly what it is, where it came from, and how it's making you feel? That in and of itself will release an enormous amount of tension, because a lot of our mental energy is used to lie to ourselves about how we actually feel. And that drains us. So once we stop doing that, that's a huge step. We come out of resistance to how we feel. And then we start really truly accepting that and who we are. And I think those are the two biggest steps.
That's great.
And again, we might have to do those a thousand times over, every, micro steps over and over.
So how do you translate this, going back to what you said before, into a company, to your point? and I, this is one thing that inspired me to this whole podcast was, I see so many opportunities for greater participation, more creativity, more honesty, more trust, if we allow more of what you might call the intuitive side of the individual to participate versus just that side that is about facts and information and data. And I've literally sat in on board meetings that basically said, unless you've got data to support your point of view, we would rather you not, raise your hand. And that just sends a ripple effect of information about who gets to participate and who doesn't. So I'm fascinated. What is it that you've done, or what would you suggest companies do who have the mindset that we have here to be open to this? How do we translate your message, your meditation into a corporate setting?
Well, one of the things I think the way the marketplace is moving for most companies, if you're mining for gold, it doesn't matter. But for most companies that have a brand or product or a product or service, they have to put a brand behind. I think you see a trend towards authenticity, right? So, and even you'll see this trend that people sell better than brands. Like, I don't care what your logo is. I want to know who the person is, and do I trust them, right? And there's this saying in marketing, nobody cares what you know until they know that you care. And so I think doing this kind of inner work brings out our true authenticity. And if that can move through the corporate culture, that can actually attract a lot of customers, and maybe actually the customers that you want instead of just everybody. I had a CEO I was coaching, and I said, I'm going to be honest, the one thing that your company is missing is you as the leader actually being in your heart and then guiding your business that way, because you're way too in your head and everyone around you can probably feel that. And then they're in their heads and now you're missing this huge part of the human experience. And then that's translating into the business. And so it's something very ephemeral. It's hard to necessarily put into a strategy and a chart, but any great creator or CEO, if you look at the Elon Musks out there, they're very intellectual, but they also have a very strong inner guidance system, an intuitive sense. And so maybe the data will get you there like 80% of the time or 90% of the time. But if you want to be at the top 1% of your business and really execute better than anybody, you're not going to get there without your intuitive abilities, without being in your heart. I think you can get there for a while, or you might have to sell out in a certain way to get there. But if you want to play the really long game that brings fulfillment and happiness to you and everybody on the planet that you touch, you can't do it without these elements. And most people are not playing that game, Dean. They're playing the average game. Yeah. They're like, get me the paycheck. You know, this is fine. But I think if you're like, you work with a lot of CEOs, right? C-suite yeah. level people, those people are saying, no, I want to be in the top 0.1 of 1% here. How do I get that? And for that, you got to go really deep into yourself. And if you don't, you're going to have a shallow life experience.
I agree. Business. And it's part of it about how we measure things. Like the form of measurement seems to also inform the behavior. And so if all we're measuring is dollars and cents and metrics and so forth, then that's what we get. Behavior follows the way in which we measure. And what's hard is that intuition is something that's not easily measurable, but it does have a downstream benefit in terms of what you're saying. And I totally agree with that. Do you think that to your point about the left and right foot, right? And I love that image that you had. And that your description of accepting the way you really feel is part of the way you might be able to have your meditation be effective, lack of a better word.
That's a good part.
Is there a coefficient on the company side that, in a sense, our predisposition towards the analytic is because of comfort and habit? Get that, but are we also sort of collectively deciding we don't want to feel what we're feeling? That as a company, we want to cut that off because we're too afraid to get into that side of what's going on with our team, our customers, our community, what have you. That it's an avoidance tactic as it is a habit tactic.
Yeah, I think you answered it, but the people that do get to do that are usually the C-suite level people that can afford a coach. And then they get to almost privately process that in themselves.
Yeah.
Like Jack Dorsey, someone who works at Twitter told me Jack likes to do these meditations, you know, in corporate meetings. But it was, they said that it felt kind of weird because it was like he was doing it for him, but not everyone was there with him. You know, not everyone's Jack with the beard and the billions of dollars and can live anywhere in the world and just explore themselves. Everyone else is like working super hard every day at Twitter to make it work. And they don't have that flexibility necessarily. So one of the things corporations, if they might need to do more is make wellness not just like an extra benefit, but a necessary part of the DNA of the business. And that's not an easy thing to do when the bottom line is the only thing that matters. And then they're like, all right, we'll do meditation, but tell me how it's going to make them more productive. And I'm like, I'm not interested in coming into your company and making your employees better batteries, even using meditation. I get it. It'll make them more concentrated. It'll make them more creative and effective. And those are great byproducts. But again, then you're not really building your business out of a strong set of values. You're still doing it for the bottom line. And so I think that intention matters. And the other thing I wanted to mention was there's this philosopher at Cambridge, Satish Kumar, I think is his name. I love this guy. I'll have to put that in notes too if we can. But, you know, he says there are two kinds of things in the world, spirit and matter. Matter we can measure. So there are things that you can, things that are made of matter have quantity. We can measure their mass. And then things that are made of spirit have quality. So you can't tell me, it's like, Dean, how much friendship do we have? Can you put that in a chart? How much love is there? Do you have with your family? You can't put that in a chart. How much enlightenment do you have? So in the world, there are two things, quality right? And quantity. So we have matter, and then we have this energy or spirit, whatever this ephemeral thing is that we use different words for in every culture. I don't think it matters so much what you call it. Maybe I prefer to call it just like energy. And so when a company's like, well, measure it for me, I don't know how you measure that. I know the government of Bhutan has a gross domestic happiness.
Yes.
And actually, I took a retreat group. I led a group there a little over a year ago, and it was beautiful. You could see that in the people. I think just surveying them and asking them what makes them happy in and of itself makes them happier, because now they're like, wow, you care about my happiness. You're validating that this is something that's important. Could you imagine the American government sending a survey out to 300 million people saying, what makes you happy?
Oh my gosh. The conversation that would ensue would be fantastic.
Instead of right now, everything is a complaint. Yeah. Everything is a problem. Everything is an argument.
Yeah.
And so, you know, negativity breeds negativity. So I don't see that until we start asking the right questions, I don't see the answers changing.
I agree with you. I think that one of the things I wanted to tie back with you on is this idea that companies, the way they're set up right now, are not necessarily predisposed to support intuition or meditation. But in some ways, you need to sort of take them where they're at. This is my two cents on this. Yeah. And so one of the things you can say is, well, do you value your values? Do you believe in your vision? Do you believe in your mission? Do you believe in your promise to serve your customer and to your employees? So when you start going down that rabbit hole a little bit, all of a sudden things like happiness and peace and the full expression of the human being and maybe even the soul, so forth, starts to come out. But that's one way you might be able to get into that discussion, I think, is through that. What's your sense?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that the issue, though, is usually the leader or leaders of a business have a vision, but they do a really poor job of expressing that vision to the rest of the company and the people in it. And so that if someone's not sharing a vision with you, they're not going to execute on it, and then they're going to frustrate you. So you have to bring them in as equals. And I think a lot of companies are structured so hierarchically, like the CEO will never hang out with some low-level employee. And so they don't really know your vision. That's why everyone and their mother wants to work for Tesla. I have a buddy who just moved to Denver, who I grew up with on the East Coast. He said, I just applied to Tesla. I want to work for them so bad. It's not the money. It's the vision.
Yeah.
It's the leadership. It's like, we're going to make the world a better place. And every single person at this company is here because they know it and they're doing it. And most companies just don't have that. That's why Elon Musk can start a space company. He can start an electric car company. He can start a tunneling company. He can start a Hyperloop. He can start a Neuralink. He can start PayPal. And everyone will follow him in any direction because they know that he is true to the vision. It's not just about money, and that he wants to change the planet. And it's crazy that these people are so few and far between, that like the rest of them are just chasing money. And there's a really great investor named Chamath Palihapitiya. I don't know if you know him. He's on CNBC all the time. He's a billionaire, really successful young entrepreneur. He actually was one of the first people at Facebook, and now he's gotten into a whole bunch of industries. But he looks at it this way as well, that you really, really have to bring something of value. And unfortunately, he says, and I agree with him, that the capital markets really are just, they're very poor allocators of money, and they just pour money into wherever they think they're going to get these huge returns. And they end up being all these stupid food delivery services or social media platforms instead of like rockets and genomics and, you know, electric vehicles. They just pour their money in whatever direction they think the returns are going to come in. So if the capital allocators don't have a vision and don't have values, and the companies need to get capital, then now they're making a deal in that direction too, and it just kind of pulls everyone down. So, you know, until everybody in the ship starts to change, it'll still sink in one direction or the other. And obviously leaders have a outsized role. And if you don't share that vision, then good luck. And I've done it. Like I have 10 or 20 people working for me, and I'll forget to tell them my vision. I'll just ask them to do some detailed tasks. And I have to remember to go back and say, hey, this is where we're going.
It's true.
So I'm guilty of that too.
I totally understand that. So David, this has been just a fascinating conversation. I could talk with you all day on this stuff, but I want to ask, how can people who are listening to this connect to your work? And then the second question is, what's up for you in the future?
Sure. Maybe the easiest way to find me is you can go to meditationschool.us. And the second place would be the app Insight Timer. So that's where a lot of my students are. It's the most used meditation app in the world. Hmm. I think there's something like 17 million folks on there meditating.
Fantastic. So
pretty cool. It's a good spot. And for the future, I've got a couple of podcasts going. I have one for sleep. I have one for meditation. And I'm in the process of, I just signed a book deal. So I have a book that's going to come out next year, about this time next year. And a couple of apps in the works. So I'm kind of a serial entrepreneur in that way. I've got a weird combination of the personal growth stuff and the entrepreneurship. Yeah. I see building businesses as like, you know how some people like to work on cars? I just like to, when I see that challenge, I just like to mess with it. And so I'm always doing like seven different things and I actually really enjoy that. So there's kind of a lot coming up all at once.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time and your energy and just all your great work.
You're so welcome, Dean. And for everyone listening, thanks for hanging with us and hope you sit down and do some meditation and shift your energy from the inside out and then see what happens on the outside.
Sounds great.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Intuition. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about Dean or Mission Facilitators Leadership, go to mfileadership.com. That's mfileadership.com.